This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Artifacts of Joy by artist Lauren Strom. Lauren's on a mission to spread love, healing, and peace through her art. Find all of her work at laurenstrom.com. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here, and I am thrilled you've tuned in for another episode of Feminist Book Club. I have such a fun discussion awaiting you with one of my favorite people, Andrea Bartz. We chat about how her first book is now being developed for a limited series, and her newest book, The Herd, which tackles the tensions associated with woman-centered co-working spaces. So I'd like to dedicate this episode to my co-workers at Modernwell and The Coven, my two woman-centered co-working spaces. I love you, and I miss you, and I hope we'll all see each other soon. Before we get into that, it is time to do a final reveal of everything in our May boxes. As you know, our theme is parenthood this month, so our book of the month is Good Talk by Mira Jacob. I've raved enough on this show about this book, so all I'll say now is it's fantastic, and you should listen to my interview with the author. It's one of my favorite episodes. I will link it in the show notes. You are welcome to sign up for just the book, and we'll ship those out next weekend. But if you'd like to support four other woman-owned businesses, might I suggest our subscription box? This month, we are featuring a charming howlite necklace from Solku, mini-sized Lara bars in their two most popular flavors, one-of-a-kind flushable bookmarks from our toilet paper queens at Bim Bamboo, and our final product is also today's sponsor. I cannot wait for you to receive your tiny feminist painting by Lauren Strom. Lauren is a Minneapolis-based artist whose sole mission is to spread love, healing, and peace through her sassy paintings, which she calls Artifacts of Joy. And that's exactly what they are. I have no doubt that your new painting will bring you so much joy. Each 3x3 painting features a different color scheme and a mantra that is sure to make you smile. So my favorite ones are the sweet reminders like vulnerable people are powerful people and you have permission to fail. But I'm obviously also a huge fan of the ones that simply say fuck because I love a good potty mouth and those make me laugh. You can see all of Lauren's art on her website, laurenstrom.com, and we've got a link in the show notes for you. If you'd like to get in on that May subscription box, make sure you get on the list early because we could possibly run out this month. I am kind of anticipating that. So head to feministbookclub.com/shop and then you can select which level of membership you would like. Finally, I'd like to invite you to check out our store on bookshop.org. In case you haven't heard of this site, it's the perfect independent alternative to Amazon. When you purchase a book from bookshop.org, 10% of your payment will go to independent bookshops around the country, and there is no better time to be helping out our indie booksellers. And when you shop through our store, we will get a part of that too. So I've compiled lists with our podcast audiences in mind, including a shoppable list of books by our previous guests and another shoppable list of books, the titles that our podcast guests have recommended. You know how I ask every author to recommend a book or two at the end of every episode? Now, all of those recommendations are in one place with a note about who recommended it. So find the link to our shop in our show notes or head to bookshop.org and search the shops for Feminist Book Club. We are the first result. All right, that's that. Let's move on to today's interview. Hi, everyone. Today, I am sitting down with Andrea Bartz. Andrea is a Brooklyn-based journalist and author of the forthcoming thriller, The Herd. Her debut novel, The Lost Night, is being developed for TV by Mila Kunis. I want to talk about that. It was named a Best Book of the Year by Real Simple, Glamour, Marie Claire, Library Journal, Crime Reads, Pop Sugar, She Reads, and so many other publications. Andrea's work has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, Women's Health,
Martha Stewart Living, Elle, and other outlets, and she's held editorial positions at Glamour, Psychology Today, and Self, among many other titles. This is our first return guest, so Andrea, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so cool that I'm your first return guest.
I know. I love that. Talked about your debut novel last spring, The Lost Night, and I loved it. The Herd, I loved even more. You didn't have that sophomore slump. This is excellent.
Thank you. Phew.
So I'm excited to talk about it. But tell me more about The Lost Night being developed for TV.
So a production company called Cartel Entertainment somehow got a hold of the book before it came out, and they reached out. Actually, the person who had found it shared it with Mila Kunis and her production company, and they all kind of felt like it was the kind of project they were looking for, and so we had some calls, and they convinced me that their vision seemed like a nice alignment with mine. They're looking to do a limited series, like what we used to call a mini series, for streaming or premium cable, which I think is great because then they can keep some of the swearing and partying and dark things that are quite key to the book, in my opinion. And so I kind of listened to their vision and signed over the rights to let them do their art. And so they are currently looking to bring in, you know, all the right people to get the green light to make it happen. So I'm not personally very involved in the process. But rumor has it there is a pilot that exists. There's a writer who's involved. So stuff is moving at what feels to me like a glacial pace, but apparently that's sort of how things go in Hollywood. Often literal La La Land. They are putting together something that I think could be a really, really awesome, fun, dark, twisty mystery show.
Oh, that sounds so good. And for our audience who haven't listened to our first conversation about The Lost Night, definitely go back and listen to that. I'll link it in the show notes, but I think it is perfectly situated for a limited series, and I cannot wait to see it. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I can't wait to see it either.
So let's talk about your newest book out March 24th called The Herd. Can you give us a brief description of it?
Sure. So the absolute quickest way to describe it is that The Herd is a thriller set in an exclusive all-female co-working space. So it's basically about this glamorous founder of this co-working space called The Herd. And there's multiple locations in New York City and across the U.S. The emphasis is on the H-E-R. In the logo, the H-E-R is always purple. The Herd is all about her. And the sort of enigmatic and beautiful founder of this business goes missing the night of a glitzy news conference and a big announcement about the company. And so her two very close friends, who are sisters with each other, it's sort of up to them to uncover sort of the haunting truth about why Eleanor would disappear. And in the process, they're sort of risking their own friendships and their careers and possibly even their lives to get to the bottom of what happened. It's dark, it's twisty, it really goes deep on complex female friendship and commercial feminism and really the sky-high standards and pressures that women experience in the world, ambitious, high-achieving women experience. And it sort of takes a close look at what happens when seemingly perfect, successful, ambitious women's perfect facades begin to crack.
Oh, and it is so good and it's so well done. I want to dig in a little bit to this idea. I've seen it described as I've seen a lot of your work described as a feminist thriller. We know what makes it a thriller, but what makes it a feminist thriller then? What are the components of that?
It's interesting to me too that so many people have picked up on that in reviews and stuff. I mean, I think the simplest answer is like feminist art is art made by feminists, right? Like it sort of naturally infuses it because I very much identify as a feminist myself. And, you know, it's Kirkus called it a soapy and fun woman-centric thriller. And whereas some other outlets are definitely calling it a feminist thriller from the start. I think, was it Hello Giggles who said that this book will make feminist thriller your new favorite subgenre. And so for me, yes, it focuses on women and they're complex and they're, you know, multi-layered and they're not always likable and they're not always sort of perfect. And I think the book, hopefully the goal was to sort of critique the social structures that force women into these boxes and force women to behave a certain way. And so the book is all about, there's all these ways that those sort of structures are not working for these women and they're crumbling around them. And I think if you read it correctly, then you'll see that it is a feminist thriller, and for those reasons. But what's interesting is that a few readers, this is like in the whole, you know, Goodreads world of people are free to think whatever they want. Some people say like, oh, this definitely isn't a feminist thriller because like the women, sometimes like the women are mean to each other. And it just kind of makes me laugh because I think it's actually pretty sexist to think that the only way that a book can be feminist is if the women are holding hands and like singing kumbaya and always being supportive and lovely and kind and sweet to each other, because that's sort of just putting more expectations on women and giving them another narrow box of how they can behave.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, so hopefully people who read it will sort of feel the feminist undertones and the sort of progressive approach that I was trying to put into it. And yeah, it seems like most people are picking up on that and calling it therefore a feminist thriller.
I love the setting of The Herd. I am unabashedly a member of two woman-owned co-working space, or two women-only, or femme-forward, I think one of them calls it. Women's spaces.
I wish I'd use that phrase in the book. That's great.
I think that Eleanor uses, she says, woman and marginalized genders. And I was like, yeah, that sounds right. That's what the language that we're using in these spaces. You're on the nose there.
yep.
So it felt like a familiar space to me, although The Herd feels even one more step elevated. It is a co-working space, but it's also a fairly exclusive social club that positions itself as inclusive. So can you talk to me a little bit about, I know that you take on commercial feminism in this book, so tell me about that approach and why you chose this seemingly inclusive, but actually it's quite an exclusive space.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real tension, and I know it's something that a lot of these spaces struggle with, simply because if you are charging money and you're running it like a business and it's a physical space that can't be too crowded, then it has to be exclusive. Like, that just has to be part of it. But I thought there was some interesting tension and irony between these spaces billing themselves as so inclusive and so feminist and so, you know, empowering and so progressive and all of those things. And so for me, it was just the setting really intrigued me. I also noticed that in my own experiences, I don't belong to a particular all-female co-working space, but I've been a guest at several ones. And I noticed that there are these businesses built with the idea that you can be free from the male gaze there and you can really, you know, let your hair down and be who you are. But whenever I was going, I found myself like carefully choosing an outfit. I would put on makeup. When I arrived, I was sort of like being the most charming version of myself and trying to just be so, you know, fit right in. And everyone else was the same way. Like, everyone there seemed so beautiful and charismatic and accomplished and amazing. And it was just like this space where you're supposed to be able to really totally be yourself, this like feminist utopia. And yet at the same time, I think maybe in large part because of our internalized misogyny and like messages that we've gotten since we're little, I'm not criticizing women for being this way. You feel like there's sort of a natural competition there. You have to be really spectacular in order to fit in. And I just thought there was so much interesting tension and irony within that, that I thought it would make a really fun setting for a thriller and for, you know, dark secrets and stuff that's sort of below the surface of this like beautiful, elegant space.
And I think you're onto something there. And what I appreciate about this book is that it could be, you could really easily have gone a very catty route where the characters, because they're in kind of a competitive space, or they do kind of have to, like you were saying, dress for success or like embody this carefree, beautiful, effortless kind of persona. It could be really easy to go like a catty cheerleader route. And I say that as a former cheerleader, so I feel like I can say that. But you treat them with a lot of respect, even though there is a lot of tension. That's just what makes it a dark thriller, right? Like, that's what makes it fun to read.
Right.
But it's still respectful. What is your approach to writing characters?
That's a great question. So for me, every character needs to represent sort of a different approach toward the same central question, the same sort of theme or goal. And so hopefully this is something that's so subtle that you wouldn't notice it as a reader, but to sort of peel back the layers of just enjoying the book and reading it. The book is very much about female ambition and about the sort of avenues that women have to succeed in what is essentially a man's world. And so the main characters all represent sort of different approaches to that, whether it means, you know, trying to gain approval and acceptance and love by being sort of the class clown, by being brash, by acting like one of the dudes. And that's kind of one of the narrator, Katie, that's sort of her approach. Or whether it's being super buttoned up and super conscientious and always anticipating other people's needs before they even think of it. And that is sort of the main approach of Hannah, the other narrator, her sister. And then we have Eleanor, the CEO, whose approach is sort of just complete perfection at all times and getting ahead by just never screwing up, which I think is a little different from those other approaches. And then we have Mickey, their good friend from college, who is the graphic designer for this space. She's an artist, and she is sort of that like bohemian, free-flowing, like dancing in the woods in a mumblecore movie kind of character that I think we all know a woman who's taken each one of these approaches. I think even within my own life, I'm sort of, you know, moving between all of them. But it was fun to explore how those approaches for them would show up in their interactions, in their decisions, in their actions, in dialogue, because I think for women, we spend a lot of time observing how other women are being received, and we pay a lot of attention to how we are being received. We're always sort of gaining feedback on like, what will people like me for? What do people come to me for? And in a way that men just don't have to think about. We are so good at like reading the room, like giving people what they want, showing them the side of us that they're looking for. And so it was fun to play with these different characters, because especially with dual narrators, I was able to sort of show the way that we envy people who seem to be pulling off this other approach, but then the person actually in those shoes is quite often going to be envying the other person right back. Like Katie, the brash journalist who says whatever comes to her head, she's sort of jealous that her older sister is so buttoned up and so together, and sort of presents that, you know, Hannah is such a martyr. Hannah won't let anyone help her. But then you go into Hannah's head, and Hannah's looking at Katie, and she's like, God, like, she's so magnetic. Guys always love her. Like, everyone who meets her just wants to be in her orbit, and I wish I could be like that. And so for me, sort of developing these different characters and treating them with a lot of love, thank you for saying that, was just about considering all the ways that I put on my armor in order to go out into the world and how exhausting it can be. And just taking into account that we're all doing our best and we're all simultaneously like ducks that seem calm above the water, but we're kicking our little legs furiously underneath. And that comes through, I think, for all of these characters in different ways when the walls start to close in around them.
And I think that's, if I could go on to like a theoretical feminist theory soapbox, I think that's kind of the hallmark of commercial feminism, is that in order to make our empowerment look effortless, we have to purchase our empowerment. And that's kind of right. The duck, you know, looking serene, but kicking furiously underwater. It's like we're trying to buy something that's going to make us, or be a part of a herd that's going to make us kicking faster. But we're going to make it look really glamorous and effortless at the same time.
Right. No, absolutely. Like the worst thing you can do is like complain about how hard things are, or, you know, make it clear that like you're upset that something didn't happen that you wanted it to, or that, you know, you don't always feel like being charming and kind to new people or generous with your time. And so, yeah, I think it gets very exhausting for people trying to do everything and make it look effortless at the same time that, especially with social media, we're just constantly staring at everyone else's feeds, wondering how they're pulling it off and making it look so easy. I think there's such an interesting irony to that, and sort of an amnesia of like, I post something and I know it makes my life look way cooler than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And yet when I look at your post, I'm like, God, like, how is Renee's life so awesome? And like, mine is so crummy in comparison. She's probably thinking the same thing, you know, like.
I think that being able to sit in the minds of two narratives, I think that was brilliant because, like you said, we're seeing multiple perspectives of the same situation, but also we're getting so much backstory. And I think that's one of the reasons why I see your writing as feminist writing, and this is a feminist thriller, is your characters are always multidimensional. There's always something that's nagging at them that doesn't maybe have a whole lot to do with the story. They have backstory. You know, we've got Katie who's dealing, well, Katie and Hannah are both dealing with their mother who's been diagnosed with cancer, and Katie just spent a year, you know, being caretaker, and Hannah is also adopted. And what does that do to the dynamic and all of these things? And I really appreciate that all is kind of percolating in the background while still pushing the narrative forward. Like, it doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with the plot, but it still feels like these are fleshed out characters and we become close to them.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I definitely feel like each one of these women by the end is a very real person to me, and I'm sad to, you know, say goodbye to them at the end. But I think the reason that happens with my books is I think a large part of it is that I don't outline before I start writing. I have a premise, I have a vague sense of who these characters might be, and then sort of as these scenes unfold, they reveal to me stuff about their background, like just piece by piece, I'm building these little, adding these little Legos of like, oh, for some reason, Katie was away. Why was she away? Because she was home taking care of her mother. Okay, so what's making her come back now? You know, just these little pieces that I'm sort of tossing in as I learn about the characters and as they sort of reveal themselves to me. And so it's like the process of writing because of that is pretty fun because it's a discovery for me as well of the twists and of the reveals and of the backstories. There's a lot of me like, knowing my characters have secrets, but I have no idea what they are until much, much later. And so, yeah, I think developing multidimensional characters really just comes down to like letting them have rich lives, lives that are as rich and complex and sometimes nonsensical and sometimes, you know, not beautiful and likable as our own inner lives are.
I'm so impressed and surprised. And I think you said the same thing in our first conversation that you don't plan out all of the details before you start writing. I am so impressed at the way that it always comes together. And I know that when you started writing The Lost Night, you didn't know who done it. You didn't know who the murderer was, essentially. Did you have a sense of who that was going into this one, or did you let it reveal itself to you?
So it was the same thing where I, again, had no idea, you know, who done it, the answers to the mysteries and how they fit together, how all the mini mysteries played into the larger one. I had no idea. And so when you say, like, I'm impressed that they come together, like, girl, you and me both, there are so many moments when I am writing that I am like looking around at all of the planes that I have flung into the air. And I'm like, how on earth am I going to land all these planes? What have I done? And so I definitely don't recommend it as a technique. It's a horrible way to write a thriller. And it means it creates a lot of misery for me. But it's just like the way that my brain works and the way that things occur to me. So, I mean, I've realized that I start with a premise and a setting that really appealed to me. In the case of both The Lost Night and The Hurt, the setting is sort of exclusive. It's this interesting sort of social milieu. It's closed door. It's close knit. There's these kind of interesting, cool characters within it that I want to, you know, take the reader behind the locked door and have them learn about it. And so then I start with some premise of the main mystery. Like with The Lost Night, it was she starts to think that maybe the suicide wasn't a suicide. And in the case of The Hurt, it was this woman, this important CEO and their friend disappears on a night that is very important to her. And so I knew that. And I just start writing from there. And it's like the first half of the manuscript or so, I'm just like flinging about these sort of loaded bear traps. I just keep introducing new, I mean, just to mix tons of metaphors, like I'm just pulling the pins off grenades left and right and figuring at some point, like hopefully my subconscious has done something where I've dropped something that later I can use in order to have everything come together and make sense. And so the first draft is just a hot mess of extraneous details because as I start to get to the point where I need to bring things together, I'm looking back over this sort of landmine I've created of things I've strewn about. And I'm going back to the stuff that I can now use to start tying things together. But honestly, like the moment that I answer a mystery for myself, who did the graffiti that's in the very first chapter? Like, what did happen to Eleanor? All of these mysteries, when I figure them out and realize how they fit together, it's like, it feels like, you know, an angel whispered it into my ear. I'm like, oh, thank God, subconscious. Like, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because 9 times out of 10, I really have set up all of the pieces. I rarely have to go back and actually do much readjusting for it to make sense. But there's just nights of staring at the ceiling and being like, this is a mess. This is never going to come together. What have I done? My career is over. Like, I'm going to have to tell my editor it's not happening. So it's only been a few times now, but something's going on below the surface, I guess, because they keep coming together somehow.
I mean, isn't that just what geniuses do? They just throw it all out there and then they take a nap. That's what I tell myself. Maybe they'll feel better.
I like the sound of the nap part of it. Yeah, I haven't heard it, but I like it. Yeah.
You know, you almost have an ethnographic approach to literature in that you say you start with the setting and you go explore the setting. I know you're at work on your third book, so can you give us kind of a taste of what that, you know, ethnographic background is?
Ethnographic, that is such an interesting way to put it. I'm going to use that. So the third book is quite different from the first two because it's not a mystery. It's still a thriller, but there's no question of who did what. And it is about, it's currently called The Visitors. We'll see if that changes, but it's about two sort of globe-trotting best friends who have been friends since college and lived in Milwaukee together. And then one of them moved to Sydney, Australia. So now, since that friend moved away 5 years ago, every year they get together somewhere in like some exotic location, like, you know, Cambodia or Vietnam or Uganda. They get together and spend like 10 days having this really wonderful vacation together, and it sort of maintains their closeness. And the book starts out with them on one of their last nights in Chile, in the Elqui Valley, which is a beautiful place I was lucky to visit last year. And to make a long story short, they, in self-defense, they end up killing a backpacker who attacks one of them. And because they're in a foreign country and like don't want to end up in jail and unable to come home, they cover their tracks and get the hell out of there. And so that's within the first few chapters of the book. And it's about their friendship, their relationship, this sort of shared trauma, and also the narrator's learning more about her friend and starting to wonder if it really did happen the way that her friend said, if it really was an accident in the way she believed. And as the walls are sort of closing in on them, it is a deep exploration of how well do I actually know my best friend, and am I in danger? Which someone pointed out is also a line that applies to The Herd and The Lost Night. So I guess I have a type in that sense.
You know, I was going to ask, and you ended up answering it already in a roundabout way, but what does it take to be an Andrea Bartz thriller? And so I think that's part of it too, is this, do I know my friends as well as I think I do? These complex female relationships.
Yeah. And I think they're especially fascinating to me because, and I think I talked about this when we talked about The Lost Night, but so much of the thriller genre is about a primary romantic relationship. It's about like someone seemed to have the perfect marriage, or like, how well do you know your husband? Or it's a widow, or it's somebody, you know, obsessed with her ex-husband and trying to get him back, or, you know, obsessed with how he has a new wife or whatever. So much of the genre is focused on these women with a husband, usually. And I am single and in my mid-30s. And so my life in no way revolves around a primary romantic relationship. And yet I feel like there's so much juicy and interesting stuff in my social life. And so I felt like there was so much terrain to sort of dig into in terms of friendships between women, because we are complex. We are, on the whole, like very socially intelligent and emotionally intelligent. And it's like I was saying before, that whole thing about a woman can read any room instantly because we've been paying attention to this stuff since we were babies. And so I just think there's so much fun stuff to play with within female friendships.
I completely agree. And that's what makes your writing so fun to read, because we can all see ourselves in at least part of some of the characters. We can, and we can always count on you for a very of the moment book. This feels like we needed to wait to 2020 to get this book. Not that 2020 has been, you know, remarkable in any way, but
no, normal year. Nothing to speak of.
But we couldn't have had this book in 2015, and who knows what it's going to look like in 2021 at this point. So it's a very of the moment book, which I really appreciate, and I always look forward to what's next from you. I cannot wait to see The Lost Night on television. So I will keep my eyes peeled for that. We are wrapping up. So we ask the same questions to every guest. What is a book that you would like to recommend to our audience that's not your own?
So there is a book that just came out, that came out shortly before mine, called Darling Rosebowl, that I haven't read yet, but I just picked up from a store. And it's by Stephanie Robal, and it sounds unbelievably creepy, and I'm so excited about it. It has, it's like a really messed up mother-daughter relationship, which, like, hell yes to another complicated relationship that's not, you know, romantic. And I'm very, very excited to read it. I think the concept is that a woman's mother went to jail for basically Munchausen by proxy. The mother was making her daughter sick, sort of as a way to get attention, which is something that we see in thrillers every once in a while. But now her mother is out of jail, and her daughter sort of takes her in and volunteers to be her caretaker. And so there's just a lot of tension right there in the setup, and why is she gonna take her in and take care of her, and what's gonna go down between these two women who have so much interesting and twisted history. So I'm very excited about that one. And then one that's coming out in April that I have read that I love, called Take Me Apart, and it is by Sarah Sliger, and it is about a young woman who is an archivist who's hired by the son of this very famous photographer, famous from sort of the 70s and 80s, who died by suicide years before. And as she's going through, so she's hired to sort of go through this photographer's estate. And as she is poking through this estate and organizing it, she begins to question the circumstances around her death and begins to question if it actually was a suicide. And so it's sort of this literary thriller, and it's really fun to read because the narrative is intercut with actual, like, documents and stuff from the estate. And so you're sort of playing detective as well and learning things and putting the pieces together and noticing little details. So it reminded me quite a bit of A.S. Byatt's Possession. So if you're a fan of that, I would highly recommend Take Me Apart by Sarah Sliger.
Those sound excellent. I've seen Darling Rosebowl floating around on kind of the book internet, and yeah, I didn't realize that it was about Munchausen by proxy. And now I'm fascinated and I need to get my little paws on it somehow. That sounds excellent. So thank you for those. Is there a, we'll link those in the show notes. We'll link all of your work in the show notes as well. And is there a medium, a social medium that you prefer to connect our audience with?
I mean, all of them are good. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Andy Bartz, AndiBartz, sharing photos, sharing my dumb thoughts on Twitter in, you know, short 180 characters. I am on Facebook at Andrea Bartz Author. And then I have a website at AndreaBartz.com, and I have a contact form there. I love hearing from people, and you can find articles I've written. I also do freelance writing and travel writing, and that's sort of my home base of things. So yeah, I would love to connect however people like.
Sounds great. We'll link that all. Thank you so much, Andy. This has been so fun to catch up with you after a year. And I look forward to the third book too.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is definitely a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.